Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way.
Hello and welcome to this Christmas festive edition of the Gig Stories podcast. I'm Alex and he is...
Oh, I'm Chris. Hello. How are you doing?
Yes, you're Chris and you're freshly back from Morocco.
I'm just back from the Kesh. Back from the Kesh. Yeah, I was rocking the Casbah.
The Casbah or the Casbah?
The Casbah.
Ah, rocking the Casbah is a different thing, isn't it? Did you rock the Casbah?
We did go to the Casbah. I mean, it's hard to rock the Casbah with 2 12-year-olds in tow.
Well, surely that's the easiest way to do it. I bet they're more rock and roll than you.
They were, to be honest. I mean, they did precisely 100% more swimming than I did, for example.
Yeah, is that because you did a little cough and put your back out?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, the weather was really good.
Oh, what a surprise.
Well, no, I was expecting it to be around about 20 degrees, but on a couple of days it was about 25. I was like, yeah, this is good. I can do with this vitamin D and, you know, warmth.
Well, as a Scotsman, I'm proud of you for not dying in that kind of weather.
It was great. I was prepared for it to... I mean, I had T-shirts, so I wore a T-shirt on most days.
Hang on, listener. I've seen this man in warm weather and he still has 5 jumpers. You wore just a T-shirt on one day.
Well, I had jeans and pants on as well, but, you know, I'm not an animal.
So did you wear shorts at all?
No.
Oh my gosh.
It was only 25 degrees. Come on.
Break. Oh my gosh, that's so funny. It's so funny. Well, you join us on this festive episode. Chris, as always, is in his cupboard in front of the door, and likewise, I am in the car.
In the car, it's great. You look so funny in there. It's like you've done something really, really bad.
It's literally the only place I could find peace and quiet away from dog, kids, washing machines and just other general 2 days before Christmas preparation going on. As always, huge thanks to Chris, the lovely Chris here, for sorting this episode out. And we wanted to get out as a festive treat because it is an absolute corker.
Well, it's a Christmas cracker.
It's
Alex,
a Christmas,
come on, it's a Christmas
it's a
cracker.
Christmas Oh, I missed that, didn't I?
Yeah.
I dropped the ball there.
Totally.
It is a Christmas cracker. Speaking of which, the best thing about Christmas, let's be honest, is Christmas crackers. Recyclable ones, of course.
Oopsie, bit of a jingle balls up here. Our recording cut out just as Alex was introducing this next segment where we each tell 3 jokes, and whoever makes the other one laugh, well, essentially wins Christmas. Alex's first joke was, what do you call a chicken in a shell suit? An egg. Not a bad effort, but I didn't really laugh out loud as such. Anyway, this is the first and last glitch of the episode. On we go!
Almost ended on the first one. Ugh. And that was for my dear father, rest in peace, who thought that was the funniest joke in the world and forgot every time he told it to you that he had told it to me 1,000 times. Come on, you're up.
Okay. At first, I didn't believe my wife when she said she hated the monkeys. And then I saw her face.
Oh, my God. Whoa, see, whoa, so
it's a tough one, isn't it?
The thing is there, I feel like I was cheating because I did drama in uni, you know. I spent
really
three years trying
three,
to keep
face. 3 years.
3 years.
Have you got the receipt?
That might be funnier than your joke. Oh, I'm okay because that wasn't the joke. Okay. Why does Father Christmas have 3 gardens?
I don't know. Why does Father Christmas have 3 gardens?
So he can ho, ho, ho.
Is there an a Christmas equivalent of tumbleweed? Is that
You've always got to bring tumble into it, haven't you?
Yeah, right. That's true, Mr. All Tumbleweed.
Right. Oh, come on, that's a good one.
That made me think. How about this for a collaboration, Mr. Tumble and the Grumbleweeds, Mr. Tumbleweeds.
Oh,
anyway, tumbleweeds. Let's not think about that for too long.
Like, that's one for all the young kids out there. Right. Go on, second joke.
Okay. I never used to be a fan of Phil Collins' Against All Odds. Well, take a look at me now. Oh, God, I'm going to have to find this tumbleweed sound.
It's a good job I did the 3-year acting course, not the one.
Yeah, you would have been struggling there.
I took a lot. Yeah. Okay, last one.
Go on.
What does Beyonce have at Christmas? Twerky. Yeah.
All right, you got.
Totally made a noise.
See, I did make a noise, and also it's the first music-related Christmas joke you've told, and I thought, yeah, it deserves a little bit of a laugh. Okay, go there.
Bring on your final one.
All right, what's Santa's favorite thrash band?
Slayer.
Yeah. You're laughing on the inside there, clown.
Well, I think, let's be honest, I think we're both losers.
Totally.
And I'm not going to expand on that.
No.
I'm going to leave it there. I think we're both losers.
Shall we get onto the episode?
Yeah, I think we should. Go on.
Yeah, I think we should. And then we'll have a little bit more chat just at the end. So our guest is Dr. Susan Rogers, who is just the most fascinating person. Well, she was Prince's producer, his chief sound engineer. Yeah, so if you like things like Purple Rain, you know, Purple Rain. Well, Susan Rogers, yeah. I could talk to you all day about Susan Rogers, and we did talk quite a lot with her. So this is a really fascinating episode.
It was one of those that was really hard to keep to, you know, time without just talking to her for hours and hours, because not just Prince, but she in the 90s was one of literally a few. I'm not even sure there was a handful of female producers. You know, she was incredible and has worked with so many people, from Crosby, Stills, Nash Young, Prince, and, you know, Bare Naked Ladies. She has an incredible career and such an insight. And Chris and I do mention her book. So,
oh, yeah, her book, This Is What It Sounds Like, What the Music You Love Says About You.
And honestly, so fascinating, isn't it? I am loving it. Genuinely, if you have any inclination or any kind of love at all for music, I promise you, you will love this book. It's so fascinating.
But anyway, let her tell you all about it and her life in music. This is Dr. Susan Rogers. Joining us for this episode is neurologist Dr. Susan Rogers, professor of music cognition at Berklee College of Music in Boston. And if that wasn't impressive enough, Susan was a multi-platinum record producer working with the likes of Bare Naked Ladies, David Byrne, Tricky, and of course, Prince, on albums such as Purple Rain, Parade, Sign of the Times, and The Black Album, and now author of a quite brilliant book called This Is What It Sounds Like, What the Music You Love Says About You. How are you, Susan?
I'm doing all right. I'm kind of laughing because I just, a couple of months ago, moved to the country, and it's always an adventure. The furnace went out last night, and I thought, oh my God, you know, what's that going to cost? But I came this morning and she fired right up. So I don't know. Every day is something new.
Is it as cold with you as it is with us? Because we've got, we're about -4 centigrade. I'm guessing you're lower than that.
Well, right about there. Yeah, if I re remember how to convert from Celsius to Fahrenheit. But this morning was 21 degrees this morning, which I think is about 0 Celsius, isn't it? So
Wow.
anyway, we're in that neighborhood. We've got snow and all that. It's
Wow.
pretty to look at.
We're going to try and warm you up with our chat, Susan.
Oh, marvelous.
We'll crash straight in, I think. And
Yes,
I, the first
yes.
thing I wanted to find out, I know that a lot of what we talk about will kind of overlap with the book. So I think if you treat our listeners as if they haven't read the book, because they all will once they've listened to this podcast, because
Yeah, absolutely.
it's such a cracker. So I wanted to know about your early memories of music, and I mean, was the music in the house as you were growing up, and did you go to live music as a kid?
No, I couldn't go to live music as a kid because I grew up in Southern California in a suburb, which was nowhere near things like restaurants and clubs and things like that. So, no, going to live shows when I was young wasn't easily done. And as for music in the house, my parents had pretty bad taste in music. My brother.
I love what people's interpretation is of that, because and
Yeah.
as I've grown older, it has changed. Because I think for a while I used to think, God, why didn't my parents play me this, this, and that? Why was I exposed to Barry Manilow and Dr. Hook?
So, what would you
Oh,
class
you had
then as
lucky.
your parents' taste in music? What are we talking here?
Well, my mother would buy these compilation albums that just was, Soul of Spain or 101 Strings, that kind of stuff.
All
You
right.
know, this is pretty soulless. And a couple of Broadway show tune albums. And then my dad was into rock and roll, but he didn't buy albums. You know, just listen to the radio. And
Was it always on in the house, or was it just
no.
a bit here and there?
No, a bit here and there. Yeah.
So how did you find your way to music then? What prompted it?
Radio, radio, radio. And I didn't realize this. I grew up in Southern California, like I said, and there were lots of radio stations to choose from. I found out as I got older that kids who grew up in the same time in the United States, but grew up out in the country, would only get one radio station. And they'd
Oh.
have to get, this, it wouldn't broadcast that far. If you were in rural New Hampshire or North Dakota or something like that, it might be rough in the 60s anyway to get a variety of music. But in Southern California in the 60s, we had a lot of great stuff. So the AM radio stations in those days would play, they made no distinction between, let's call it black and white music, but they made no distinction between Motown and James Brown and funk and soul and Sly and the Family Stone and all that
Yeah.
with the Monkees and the
Yeah.
Beatles and that kind of stuff that you would also hear, Herman's Hermits and just the usual complement of music that was around in the early 60s. So yeah, that's where I got my musical taste from.
Were there bands or artists in particular that sort of caught your ear, so to speak? Were you like, oh, who is this? Who is this? Who were those artists
And
in that
don't
early
you,
days?
yeah, and don't you think that's one of the most amazing things that a human brain does? Little children, I firmly believe this, little children know who they are and they know what they like. I think adults try to interfere and tell them who they are, and they listen to adults. But when I was a little kid, and you guys have probably had this experience too, I remember that feeling, which I still get today, of a record coming on that you're hearing for the very first time, and you're thinking, this is it. This is a different category of music. This is my music. Now, for me, that happened with James Brown. It happened with the
Yes.
Rolling Stones. A little bit later, it happened with Led Zeppelin. They're just certain artists listening to Jimmy Page on guitar connected with me more than listening to Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton, his contemporaries, who were great, 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 great. No denying how great they are. And you could say technically they're probably equivalent, but just there's something that goes beyond the technical appraisal and just makes you feel a sense of recognition where you say, yeah, now that's what I'm talking about. For me, James Brown and Sly Stone were closer to my kind of artist than like Motown and the Motown stuff. I mean, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder from a
Oh,
bit,
yes. Yeah.
Smokey Robinson, undeniably great, but didn't give the same reaction.
And when you were that
I
young, when you were really young, how much did what you saw make a difference to if you listened to them or not? Because I remember when I was really young, so I was born in kind of mid-70s, and so early 80s, I remember the first band that I really not got into because I was like five, but I saw them on telly, and it was a band called the Stray Cats, and I
Oh yeah.
remember I loved them. Do you know the Stray Cats? I can't even remember if they were American or if they were British.
Canadian, I
Canadian,
thought.
right?
Canadian.
And I think part of what I loved it, because they were real kind of rockabilly kind of, but with a bit of punk. And I remember seeing them on Top of the Pops and thought, whoa, who are they? What? And I think it was more that I connected with what they looked like at that age than what they sounded like, because I couldn't whistle you a Stray Cats tune now. I just remember when I was five, they were it. So I'm wondering if image was anything that you paid attention to when you were really young and listening to music.
That's a great question, and you're bringing up how the generational differences are mediating our taste in music through the technology. I mean, think about the kids who grew up who for whom MTV and music videos always existed. And I'm older than you
Yes.
guys, so no, when I was young, if you wanted to see music on television, you'd have to tune into those afternoon shows, the dance shows like Hullabaloo and Shindig. And oh boy, we had Soul Train. Soul Train was so great in the 70s.
Yeah.
We had a few TV shows that would have live bands, and that was always tremendously exciting, but it wasn't nearly as common as what it is today and in later generations. And mostly when you'd watch those shows like Shindig or Hullabaloo and things like that, you might see a band like the Rolling Stones come on, for one song, but mostly what the camera focused on was kids dancing. So it wasn't, and it always felt a little bit stilted, a little bit stiff. Those live performances on TV don't come across the way records do. My friend, the brilliant Tommy Jordan, musician, he's quoted all throughout this book that I've written, because Tommy taught me so much about music. And Tommy told me after the very first time that he and his band, he was a part of Geggy Ta on David Byrne's label, and his partner was Greg Kurstin, who's a very successful producer today. Anyway, Tommy and Greg had a early morning TV appearance in Los Angeles one morning, early morning. And Tommy's first time on TV, he's the lead singer, and he's looking in that camera, and he realized, I don't know how big to make my performance gestures. The camera. So in the studio, your performance gestures have to be small because the music delivery system is headphones or might be speakers, but you're singing right to an individual. On stage, of course, you have to sing all the way to the back of the club or the back of the arena, should you be so lucky. But on TV, you kind of have to be in the middle there. If your performances are too big, you'll look like an idiot, like you're over-emoting. And if your performances are too small, they won't connect with viewers. So I think when I was a little kid, I probably on some level, as I assume a lot of music-loving kids are, I was picking up on that and like, yeah, they're not as exciting on TV as I imagine they are live.
So when that makes me think then, when did you sort of, so you're listening to the radio, you're really starting to fall in love with music. And I'm thinking this is how I did as well. When did you then think, hang on, I could listen to these artists live? Because I think it took me a long while, because I was aware that my mum maybe once, twice a year would go to a concert. And more often than not, it would be, I grew up in Cardiff in Wales. And more often than not, it would be the Everly Brothers when they would come around every couple of years, or Neil Diamond. And I remember it being a really special event, because we were very working class and didn't have a lot of the spare cash, and so it would be a big event. Whereas I've spent my life going to gigs almost weekly. W And it wasn't until I was older that I thought, hang on, I am obsessed with Michael Jackson. And I say older, this is in the 80s, you know, as a kid, thinking, I can see him performing these records live. What is that all about? So when did that sort of click with you? And so when did you think, I need to go to concerts?
Same as you, grew up in a household. My parents, when I was young, never went to a live show that I'm aware of. I mean, we just didn't have money for things like that. My mother was ill for a lot of my youth. She passed away when I was 14. So going to concerts, it wasn't an option. So like you, I didn't become really aware of it until I was a teenager. And you go to school and the other kids will talk about they saw so-and-so last night. And oh, I missed out. So what would it take for me to be able to see a live show? Well, I'd have to scrape together in these days, you know, $20 or $25 or something like that. And you might have an after school job. So you'd put in a bit of work if you wanted to see
yeah,
a
me
band.
Too.
It wasn't necessarily easy. I didn't see my first, what you would call a concert, until I was probably 20 years old. And that first one was Yes, band Yes. So I'm at the Long Beach Arena, and that was pretty exciting.
How big a gig would that have been, Long Beach Arena?
Long Beach Arena, if I'm recalling, is around 3,500, maybe 4,000.
Okay.
Bigger than the Universal Amphitheater, so not about around 4,000 or 5,000. It was a fairly big gig.
And was that a big moment for you? Was that a yes, I come into town, I want to see these?
Yep, I did the work of, this is going to sounds like I ride a dinosaur, but all right, for the youth of today who are listening, one way you could get tickets in those early 70s, 60s days is you just write a letter, piece of paper in an envelope with a stamp on it. You'd write a letter and include a check to the box office, and you'd say, here's my money, please send me 2 tickets to this show. I was naive. I didn't know about going and waiting for the box office to open. I wrote them a letter, and turned out that ended up being a really good way to get tickets, because my first concert for myself and a friend, I got tickets right on the floor. As I'm visualizing it, I think it might have been the 30th or 40th row, but it was really good seats.
Wow.
So yeah, you'd write and they'd send you the tickets in the mail.
Can you imagine that nowadays? Harry Styles is playing the local stadium, so I'm going to send a check for a start.
Well, I think the kids would be like, "What? Sorry, what's a check?
What's an envelope?
What's a letter?
What's a
yeah.
yeah, yeah, yeah."
It's okay, kids.
Maybe with the Taylor Swift fiasco that happened recently, maybe that's the way to do it.
It is just wacky letters in the post and whoever's come first.
But I used to love going to the because when I first started going to gigs regularly was the mid 90s, and it wasn't so arbitrary as sending a check in the mail, but it was, you would go to the record shop, you go to the music shop, and you would say, I'd like tickets to this, and they'd open this drawer and then just kind of flick through all the and you look over and go, oh my god, look at all those things.
Yeah.
And the joy of getting an early ticket, because obviously the tickets were all numbered, and if you I hope I'm kind of in the you know, under 100, and you know, because it meant you were an early adopter, you were quick off the mark and a proper fan, you know.
The thrill of that was so exciting. After I wrote about this in the book briefly, but I got married when I was 17, and turned out to be fortunate for me that he was a real nasty piece of work. And I say that was fortunate because it gave me a get out of jail free card. I had a pass to escape. And so I escaped when I was 21 and got away from this person. And after that, you know, the floodgates were opened and I had friends and I went to a lot of shows with them. And I was living in Hollywood at this time, starting my career as a recording engineer. So the Roxy and Whiskey A Go-Go were just up the street. So you guys probably did this too. You remember going with your friends and camping out overnight in front of the box office, where you'd sit on the sidewalk and kids would just bring, you know, you bring a cooler, you bring some beverages, you bring a sleep
yes.
bag or whatever, and you'd just wrap up and you'd sit on the sidewalk waiting for the box office to open. Do you remember Ian Drury?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Fabulous. I saw them, and I saw Lou Reed there. I saw Peter Gabriel right after he left Genesis at the Roxy, on the Roxy stage. He
what?
Climbed into the balcony. Yeah, he climbed into the balcony during a show, and I rubbed his head. For good luck, we called it. We saw Todd Rundgren, and there were a lot of great artists at the Roxy.
How big a venue would that have been? Because Ian Drury, surely that wasn't he wouldn't have played there regularly, would he? Or was he?
He was actually opening for, I don't remember who he opened for because he was so good, but it would have been 78 or 79.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Roxy is small, 250 people, 300 maybe.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's quite small. So you just, there's no, you know, you it's like a pub. You stand on the floor in front of the stage and there's seats, a couple of small balconies, and there's a little riser. But
and that's where you saw Peter Gabriel off the back of Genesis.
Yeah, right after Genesis, and that was amazing. That was really amazing. He's an amazing live performer.
I think he's touring next year as well. Actually,
he is.
Yeah,
he is. Yeah, he's just announced. Now, I'd like to refer on listening to your book. I started making copious amounts of notes and then had to stop because I realized, I mean, this would have to be a 2-day interview with you for me to ask all the questions. But I'm sort of glad that you mentioned your marriage, because the very first note I made was Led Zeppelin and live music being an outlet from and the words I've put are being trapped in a marriage. And I don't want to go into that, but you mentioned that it was obviously a horrible relationship that you got out of. But you mentioned, you talk early on in the book about a Led Zeppelin gig and how that might have been, you know, the sort of final straw that you just thought, right, I'm going to perhaps get out of your marriage, but also led you onto the professional path that you went on. Tell us about that gig, because tell us about that gig anyway, because I'd sell my grandmother to see Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, it was kind of a if you know the movie Gone with the Wind and Scarlett O'Hara shaking her fist at the sky and saying,
yes,
as God is my witness, I'll never go hungry again. It was the big panoramic, you know, the sun is setting, and it was one of those moments.
Yeah.
But it was a turning point in my life. So I had friends who loved Led Zeppelin, but I don't think they loved them as much as I did, because Led Zeppelin was my favorite band. And you remember, they were golden gods in the 70s. They ruled in the United States anyway. I know it was a little bit harder for them in the UK, but holy moly, they were gods here in the 70s. And they were coming to town, 76, I think it was, maybe 77, for the Song Remains the Same tour.
Right.
And I had a ticket to see them with friends at the Forum in Los Angeles, which seats 14,000 people. It's where the basketball team, the Lakers, play. It's a big arena. On the ticket, it said that the show started at 8 o'clock. It didn't say anything about an opening act. There wasn't one. And the person I was married to insisted, he was very, very jealous and very possessive. He wouldn't let me out of his sight, but he let me go to this. He had zero interest in music. He let me go if I promised to be home by 10 o'clock. And I looked at the ticket and I thought, okay, yeah, maybe they'll play for 2 hours and I'll probably make this 10 o'clock deadline. So I said, yes. And then I got there with my friends, were up there in the rafters, and Led Zeppelin didn't even take the stage until 9 o'clock. they were just getting warmed up, and I'm looking at my watch, and I'm supposed to be enjoying the show, and I'm realizing, oh my God, because it's John Bonham. It's John Bonham.
Exactly.
Was there another human being that ever played like that? I mean, it's this man, this force of nature on drums, John Paul Jones, one of the most underrated musicians who's ever contributed to records.
Absolutely.
Robert Plant, who, of course, had everyone, all the women anyway, just swooning, and I was one of them. And then there's Jimmy Page, and he was just this
God.
Dervish. Yeah, it was one of the greatest things I'd ever seen, and I just couldn't even contain how exciting it was. But looking at my watch, to be honest with you, if I stayed and watched the end of that show and got home late, I would go to work the next day with a black eye. That's how bad it was. So I had a choice. And not only would I have a black eye, but I'd have this jealous, controlling person who would never let me go to another show. So I thought, I've just got to get out of here. And I've got to strategize how to get back in and how to correct this horrible situation. So I got up and I'm leaving. My friends are like, what are you doing? You're leaving. This is your favorite band. It's okay. I had to go. But as I was walking out, I just stopped. And I looked up at the rafters and I just made that silent vow to myself. I said, I'm coming back here. And then I said to myself, and I'm going to mix front of house, live sound for an amazing band. And no one is going to tell me to leave. So I left. And then with some minor modifications, that came true. So I left. I left the forum 6 months later, I suppose. I left the person I was married to. I escaped. I began my career in Hollywood, worked as an audio technician. Prince, my then favorite artist in 83, was looking for an audio technician. That's me. Look no further. That's going to be my gig. He hired me, and my very first tour as a working professional was the Purple Rain Tour, and we played the Forum. We actually broke attendance records at that time. We did 7 nights at the Forum and 3 nights at the Long Beach Arena on that LA tour. Neil Diamond broke our record later, but we held the record for a while. Anyway, this was 85, I think it might have been, maybe 84, not even 84. We were at the Forum, and I was not mixing front of house, but I was in the mobile recording truck. I was recording the show in the record plant mobile, parked behind the stage, my hands on faders, recording this live show. And I remember, I went after sound check, recorded sound check, and took the cassette to Prince in his dressing room to give him the sound check so he could, you know, just check all the sounds, make sure everything was good, give me some last minute tips. And I told him about my Led Zeppelin experience. And then I said to him, I just want to thank you because you've made my dream come true. And that face, you know, you could see in his face. I knew him really well. I was essentially, this isn't bragging, this is a fact of my working relationship with him. He recorded every day. So he and I were joined at the hip for 4 years. I knew that face, but that face just lit up when I told him that story. And you could see in his face, you could see, he was a man of few words, but you could see in his face that he's thinking, yeah, me too. This is my dream. It was pretty great. And then, this sounds silly, but I did it. I lingered that night before I left that building. And I looked up at those rafters and I thought to myself, I told you.
Yes. There's a previous guest of ours called Johnny Calci, who's a phenomenal teacher and musician. He's a Dole drummer. And he's just superb. But one of the things he talks about is manifestation and the universe and putting things out there and just going, this is going to happen. And by the sheer action of saying that, that's going to manifest itself in the event happening. And I think he would approve of that. And the way that you did that, you kind of manifested it and went, this is what's going to happen. And it did.
Yeah, it's a mystery because I would really like that to happen with my furnace right now. You will work. I insist upon it. And I'm a woman of science. And so being a woman of science, I'm looking for causality.
Yeah.
Looking for cause and effect. What caused this to happen? Because simply believing that something is going to happen does absolutely nothing for making it happen. But belief changes your actions.
Yeah. Belief or maybe it only happens once. Yeah. Maybe it happens once in your life and you didn't waste your one time.
Yeah, yeah.
You could have held on to that, and then the one time it does work is you get your furnace to work. And that would have been a waste. But you managed to... Yeah,
that's an interesting philosophy that you get one throughout your life, and you can either be for something big or you can use it for something really small. Please let my car start this morning. Okay, now you're done.
No, you used yours. You worked with Prince.
Exactly. So your furnace is broken. Good luck with that.
Damn.
Can I ask, because when you have the career that you have had, and it's easy just to mention Prince because he is Prince, isn't it? You know, there's so many people you've worked with, legends. I mean, David Byrne and Bare Naked Ladies and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. If I remember, you
I
know.
Was their technician. Yeah, that was my first.
That's your first. Oh my goodness.
With an artist, yeah, I was their tech, yeah.
So we could have a whole podcast just talking about the experience of working with those artists in the studio, but especially with Prince, because two of us in this three have seen Prince live, and one of us sadly never got to see him live. And it is just a horrible, horrible, horrible regret of mine. Do you remember, because we, you know, on this podcast, we talk about the live experience, but do you remember that first time seeing him play live?
Yes, I do. So I'm a big Prince fan, and I'm living in Hollywood, and I think the year was 1980. And okay. I had to see Prince on the Dirty Mind tour.
Right.
And he played at Flippers. It's the building is there, but the club isn't anymore. It was called Flippers in the corner of Santa Monica Boulevard and La Cienega, right in Hollywood. Do you remember that period in the late 70s, early 80s when everybody was roller skating?
Yeah. Yes, randomly, everywhere.
Yeah, it was the kind of place where it was a wooden floor where people roller skated. Anyway, the Dirty Mind Tour, they played. And so... Downstage, Prince is in the center. Andre Simone on bass. What a bass player. Mm-hmm. Des Dickerson on guitar. And then in the back is Matt Fink on keys, Bobby Z on drums, and of course the goddess Lisa Coleman is on stage. And the guys in the front row, Prince included, they're wearing these bikini briefs and the trench coats and the little neckerchiefs, and the Prince had the thigh high stockings and these black boots, and they just had gloves with the fingertips cut off, and the God, what a show. Oh my God, what great players. And then there's Lisa on stage in her lingerie, camisole, a trench coat, and she's got this black hair that comes and hangs over one eye, and she's got her ashtray right there on her keyboards, and she'd take a drag on a cigarette and exhale and blow that hair up out of her face. She had these long gloves on, and it was unbelievable. Just enough to levitate you. What a great, great man they were.
And there it is. And for me personally, as I've listened to your book and listened to how you speak about music, whether it's listening to recorded or live, that I get that. And I got it from the first time I went to live gigs, that spiritual, and not, you know, conflating that with whether I think there's a God or not, that sort of spiritual, that levitating, that, oh my gosh, this is the greatest thing in the world. And in that moment that you will never be able to recreate, it is just the greatest thing ever. Yeah. And And I love that because I love it when I get it in a pub size gig from just one person, an acoustic guitar. And I love it when it is, I'm in a stadium and it's you two. And it's the Zoo TV tour and it's 1992 and it's one of the biggest tours of its kind. And I just didn't know what to do with myself as Bono is lifted up on this massive TV screen into the middle of the stage and they play. I just in that moment was thinking, oh my gosh, life will never be the same again. It can never get better than this actual moment. And I just love how, you know, music has obviously connected like that with you through the years. Do you still have that feeling when you see live music?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. And can't you, the thing you're describing, can't you kind of tell when the artists on stage are really making an effort to connect with you? There are some shows where you sort of can tell, you know, they're good and all that, but I think they're just going through the motions. And again, that's another challenge for brain scientists to discover. But we, consumers of music, consumers of art, we do pick up on cues that express intentionality, what someone is trying to do. And that's an interesting thing. When you see a show where the performer like Bono or Prince or someone like that is focused on you and your experience, that can give you a much better show than when you sense that performer is maybe kind of lost in their own heads and isn't really aware that you're out there. I still get that feeling today. And another thing that's an interesting challenge for brain scientists is what the hell that is. It feels to me a bit like a sort of recognition. Like,
oh yeah, absolutely.
When you hear something, a piece of music, or you see a band that gets you to that state, it must be something within yourself that you're recognizing.
Yeah, I think one of the earliest things that you would have. I'm a photographer, and yesterday I had a job. I was photographing this workshop for 2 and 3 year olds, and I think because I've got a child myself, and I mean he's 12 now, but I do remember that when I was communicating with him when he was tiny, the main thing was to make absolute eye contact, and I can imagine that is probably, even if it's not an actual specific memory, but that connection is there. And that's what that's what I was doing yesterday with these 2 and 3 year olds. And by the end of it, you know, one of them gave me an apple. No. I mean, that's one of the best gifts I've ever been given. Part of it was because I was looking straight into their eyes when I was speaking to them. And, you know, even if they weren't making sense with the words they were using, I was making them think that they were making sense. Mm-hmm. And Alex, you'll have this. I mean, Alex is a bit of a children's television legend in the UK. And you'll have had that as well, Alex, I'm guessing.
Yeah. You create a connection. And in person, when you're one-on-one, that is easier.
We seek it out. And I think when you've had that as a tiny person, that's what you're looking for in every interaction. But if it's something that you can have from somebody who's, you know, 50 meters away on a stage, that's difficult to do.
My brain's going 10 to the dozen here, because there was a very famous children's television presenter in Britain from the 60s and 70s, Floella Benjamin, and I was a presenter on children's television in on the BBC, Susan. Mm. And I met Floella and early on, and she said, when you look down that television camera, you're speaking to the one. And she said, do you have a child? And at the time I was just a dad. And she said, well, think of your daughter. And so I tried to connect to a camera and I put effort in and I hoped that people got it. But as we're talking about music, it's interesting because it's slightly different, because you're there on a television. I speak down a television camera and then it's on P people's televisions in their living room. But I'm thinking now, as you've been speaking, I've seen bands that I love play really bad gigs. Mm-hmm. And one of them, so Oasis, I just happened to see Oasis from the start. So I saw them in small venues. I saw them at Nebworth, where they played to, you know, 500,000 people over a weekend. And I very nearly left I would have left the gig if I wasn't giving someone a lift home, because they came out in the Millennium Stadium in front of 60,000 people. And it's one of the worst gigs I have ever seen in my life, because there was no connection. I could see they were plodding through it. So I'm not seeing whether their eyes are connecting with me, but there is something there, isn't there? Yeah. There's something in the performance and the body language that you just think, hang on. And it affects the music and the sound of the music as well to me. Because obviously when U2, when Bono was being lifted up in his PVC or leathers, or it's a theatre. And along with that theatre and that performance and that music, that connects. But I've seen bands, the artists that I love, Bob Dylan keeps coming up. Because, you know, Dylan famously, rubbish gigs, amazing gigs, rubbish gigs, amazing gigs. You know, I've seen him sat in the back corner of a stage, didn't even look at the audience, you know. So it is funny what makes us connect and what doesn't connect. Have you seen an artist that you really love and admire play what you think was a terrible gig?
Yes.
And are you able to explain why as well?
In this case, yes. It was Prince. And you wouldn't think, you wouldn't have thought he was capable of a bad gig. But here's
sit down, everyone. This is going to be good.
Yeah, we were on the Purple Rain tour, and we were out for months. That was a long, long, long tour. And the very last show on that tour was Miami, Florida. Now, Prince, being as creative as he was, meant that he was easily bored. So if he's on stage every night, he can't wait to get in the recording studio. And if he's in the recording studio for weeks or months at a time, he can't wait to get out on the road.
Hilarious.
Been out a long time. And I remember that gig, that very last gig on that tour, I remember thinking, this is awful. But I thought, oh, maybe it's just me. Maybe I just want to go home. But it seemed sloppy and rushed and bleh, like he wasn't into it. A couple of years ago, after Prince passed away, they're releasing some of his material.
Mm.
And one of the things they were considering releasing and did release was a live show from the Purple Rain tour. So I was sent, they were gracious enough to send me some of those shows and ask me what I thought of them. They sent me that Miami show. I remembered correctly. It almost doesn't even sound like him.
He's no way.
He's rushing through these songs, his banter with the audience, all of it is suggesting, oh, please just let me get out of here. Just let me get off this stage and get out of here. Now, he was such a professional performer, but here he is. I mean, you know, he's a kid. He might have been 25 yes. years old, maybe 26 at that time. He's a kid, brilliant as he is, but he's a kid. And he's done his job. He's showed up every night and performed every night for months at a stretch. He just won an Academy Award. He won these Grammys. He won these American Music Awards. And he really just wants to be in the studio. He can taste it. So yeah, you could hear in the audio files that they sent me, it was clearly evident he wants off that stage.
So the thing that I immediately want to say is, how many other people in that place thought that? Or, as often happens, was everyone just on a blissful Prince trip and it was just you and maybe a few other people going, oh, this doesn't sound right?
Yeah, you know, that brings up the quotable Tommy Jordan again, who said that a gig doesn't always sound like what it feels like to do. A band can come off the stage and think, that was one of the worst gigs ever. And the front of house mixer, I've been in this position, can say to them, you guys were on fire tonight. That was amazing. And other times you'll say to them, what was up with you guys? You weren't on your A game tonight. And they'll say, we thought we did great. So there's a disconnection between sometimes what it feels like to give and what you actually perceive, you know, from further back in the room. I think the odds are really good that there were folks in the majority of folks at the in Miami having a great time. They're with their friends, it's friends on stage, and this is another factor, they're pot committed. They spent money.
Yes.
And when you've spent money on something, you really want to like it.
Yeah, that's true. Do you think then, do you think you have the ability to go to, so if I was just to come pick you up now from your house and take you off to a gig, a live concert, do you have the ability now to sit and listen to live music without being analytical?
Oh, yeah, I love it so much. I love being sung to. I like being played to. Because I'm a non-musician, I haven't been on stage. I'm not a performer. My entire relationship with music is as the receiver of it.
Mm.
Certainly, I've worked as a record producer and an engineer. An engineer is manipulating the sound to assist with that music delivery. The producer is listening to the individual performances to assist with the delivery of that material. So that's the kind of analysis you perform in the studio. But now, when you go live, you're being sung to. You're being played to.
Yeah. That reminds me, I'm going to do a name drop on your behalf. You met Miles Davis,
yes,
Junior, and he gave you one hell of an experience and one hell of a quote, didn't he?
Yeah,
and you stood your ground with him as well, because I can imagine, I can imagine he was quite an intimidating personality. yeah, tell us about Miles.
So,
tell us about Miles. They're words I never thought I'd say.
Yeah, boy. So Prince called one day, when I was in Prince's employ, and he called and he said, Miles is coming over the house for dinner. Can you pull? And he labeled four songs he wanted me to pull off from the vault, get these tapes out, and be ready downstairs, because after dinner, they're going to come downstairs to where his home studio was, and they're going to listen to some music. So, you know, yes, boss. Right away, I grab these tapes and I get to the house and I go in through the back and I'm downstairs in the home studio and I'm waiting and I can hear them upstairs. And them was Prince, Miles, and Prince's dad, a jazz musician named John Nelson. Prince adored his father. So the three men are upstairs and they're having dinner. The year would have been 87. And then shortly I hear those familiar footsteps coming down the stairs, and it's Prince. And he comes running down, and he looks at me, and he goes, you won't believe this. He kind of points over his shoulder. And coming down the stairs are Miles and John Nelson. And they come down, and they're in the studio, and Miles parks himself right in front of me, with his back to me. I'm standing next to the tape machine, and Miles is in front of me. I could, you know, just put my hand on his shoulder. He's that close. And he's got his back to me, and he's facing John Nelson. And John Nelson is telling him, and they both talk like this. I like those pants you got. And Miles is saying, what pants? And those striped pants. I don't have striped pants. Yes, you do. I've seen you. Where did you see me in striped pants? I saw you on TV. Where was I on TV? At the Grammys. I don't have striped pants. And they're going back and forth about whether these striped pants exist. And all of a sudden, Miles, he spun around and he put his face right in front of my face. And he said, yes, I do. They're made out of eel, like in Vietnam. And those words just don't go together. And his face was right there, so I kept my face right there, and I just had to say it. Eel, like in Vietnam. He said, who are you, Susan? Where are you from? Anaheim. What do you do? Recording engineer. How long you been here? For about 4 years. He's just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, asking me other questions, just with the short answers. And he's there and I'm there, and we're just kind of toe to toe. I don't know what he wants from me, but I'm gonna keep up my end of the conversation. And then he says, you musician? And I said, no. He said, that's okay. But he said, that's okay. I think he said, that's okay. And then he said, some of the best musicians I know are not musicians. And he turned
there
around.
You go.
Yeah. And that was the end of it. And it took me a long time to figure out, did he mean that some of the best players he knows could play like non-musicians, which I found out later from Marcus Miller and other people who played with him that, yeah, that was true. But he also meant that some of us non-musicians are musical.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to fully embrace that, I wasn't as wise when I was younger as I am now, but I know what he meant. I'll never forget that.
I know that we could talk to you all day. I just want to know about how the book came apart. It came apart. Came about. It hasn't come apart.
I've got mine. I'll keep rereading it. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is what it sounds like. How did it come about, and why did you decide to structure it in the way that you did? Because I find it is a proper page turner in that it just flows so well, and that's because of the structure. What was the thinking behind it?
I appreciate the compliments very much. This is my first book. So I was approached by a fellow named Ogi Ogas, who is kind of a professional co-author. That's what he does. He's written a lot of books, but as a co-author. So he finds people who have an interesting base of knowledge or stories to tell, and he helps them put that into book form. So he approached me and asked, would you like to write a book about music? And I said, well, no, I'm not a musician, and my students know more about music than I do. I can't write anything about music, but I can write a book about music listening, because that's what I do. I've been sort of a professional music listener my whole life. I've gotten paid to listen as a record maker and as a scientist now to talk about it. So we said yes. Then the first thing that had to happen is to pile all the clay on the table, all the things I teach in class, all the things I learned in grad school at McGill University in Montreal, things I learned in the recording studio in different roles as a mixer or an engineer or producer, pile all that stuff on the table, and then push that clay around to see what shape would be ideal for it. As we're pushing that clay around and I'm gathering all this material together, Ogi and I realized there's a new model of music cognition in here, a new model of that describes the brain science that underpins listening. So what I'm describing in the book is that there are at least seven dimensions of recorded music, live music too, but that there are more variables in live music. So let's talk about recorded music. There are at least seven dimensions that can, independently of the others, give us a sonic treat. They give us a little jolt of dopamine. So the musical dimensions are the melody and the lyrics and the rhythm and the timbres, the sound itself. The aesthetic dimensions are things that apply to our love of all art, you know, whether it's movies or books or TV or whatever. So that would be things like novelty. Some of us like novel music. Some of us like the more familiar styles. Things like realism. I like records made with real musical instruments. Other people like electronic music made with in-the-box instruments, software. And then the dimension we've been talking about, authenticity, where those performance gestures are coming from, which can come from the head or the heart or the belly button, seemingly. So we wrote about that and organized the chapters are the seven dimensions. And then the final chapter, which I enjoy, enjoyed writing, is falling in love, that love at first listen moment when you hear a record, like we started talking about it, you hear a record and you just recognize, oh, now that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. That's the music of me. This is expressing my inner self.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing when that happens.
You introduced me to a band which has absolutely blown my mind.
The Shags.
Yeah. Yes. Now, I'd never heard of them. I'd never heard them. And do you know what? They remind me of, you know, when there are these news stories about an extinct volcano, which has started to grow, and there are life forms. You know, there's a species of monkey which has just evolved in a complete. It's like they've never heard music before, and they've just got their instruments and decided, right, this is what we're going to do, and we don't have any rules. And I'm not saying it's an easy listen by any stretch. It's just so, it doesn't sound like anything. It doesn't sound like they've got any influences. How would you describe the Shags?
The Shags are what we call an industry band, in the sense that people in the music business know who they are, because record makers especially will play the Shags for one another to show them something. So the Shags are to music what a child's finger painting is to art. Child's finger painting isn't going to go in a museum because there's no technique there. But because there's no technique, because the child is so naive, when you're looking at the kid's finger painting, all you see is what they're trying to do. And what they're trying to do is so pure. They're trying to say, this is my world. This is my house. Here's mom and dad. This is my dog. This is what the world looks like to me. So the Shags allow us to hear pure intentionality in music. They were, I almost said popular. They were never popular. They were making music in the 1960s. They grew up in rural New Hampshire. Rural. I mean, they might not have received any radio stations, or if they did, it might have been one and only at certain times during the day. But their dad was a really, really nasty dad, in that he believed his daughters were going to be really successful as a pop band, like the Beach Boys or, like, I don't know, Supremes or something. So he pulled them out of school, refused to let them have a social life. They couldn't go to parties or see boys or anything. And he gave them musical instruments, bass, drums, and guitar, and said, learn these and write songs. So these three sisters, Betty...
It's crazy, isn't it? Yeah. It's crazy, yeah. Just saying that.
Okay, they didn't even know how to tune their instruments. But,
you can hear that.
Yeah, the genius of it is, Dad raised a bit of money, which was hard because he was a mill worker. He didn't have a lot of money, but he raised some money, went down to a recording studio in Boston, got them in the room, in the recording studio. And the stories told by the engineers who were the first professionals to hear them were, girls would be playing this horrible sounding music and one of them would stop. And they'd look at Dad and go, why'd they stop? And Dad would say, because they made a mistake. And you're wondering, how could you tell?
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
The drum fills, they don't come back in on time. But these women will be all out of time and out of tune together.
Yeah.
Yes.
They will collectively forge a new kind of music. So what they illustrate for professionals is, damn, the wrong note played with gusto sounds better than the right note played timidly. And I don't care how technically trained you are, if you don't express yourself on your instrument, you're talking loud and saying nothing.
Yep.
We're
oh, that's brilliant.
So yeah,
totally.
That's the Shags. They don't know how to do it, but they're doing it with all their might.
That is absolutely so funny.
Because sometimes I can't tell if they're actually singing in English. That's one of the
yes.
Like, wow, yeah. You have to retune your ears, but it's quite something. Sorry,
and you know
Alex,
what?
As soon,
no. As soon as I heard. For those of you listening that don't have the book, either buy the book and read it or get the audiobook, because Susan herself narrates it and it's wonderful. And as soon as I heard you say that Frank Zappa said that they were better than the Beatles, I knew exactly what I was going to hear when I pressed play. And they are incredible, but every artist should listen to them, because you've nailed it there, Chris. It's they have no point of reference, no nothing. And you're just like, so this is what it sounds like when you just are being pure, genuine. And if you can take that and turn it into what we would know as rhythm and good chord progressions, I reckon if you got Jack White and said, right, can you take this and just change it a bit, they'd have massive selling records, because there absolutely is stuff there. But you, to our ear, you're there. I was listening to it going, this is incredible. this is incredible for so many reasons. It's just is unbelievable.
You're right. There is something there, and there's there's a kind of poetry to their lyrics. Their album is called Philosophy of the World, but there's one song that says, "Oh, the fat people want what the skinny people the rich people want what the poor people got, and the girls with long hair want what the girls with short hair." They're right.
They're exactly right.
They're exactly right. Totally. You hold that up against Brian Wilson's masterpiece, In My Room. There's a world where I can go and tell my secrets to in my room, do my crying, do my sighing, laugh at yesterday. The mythologist Joseph Campbell wrote about a universal truth. You know, the height of elegance is simplicity. And when you really are a genius, you can distill complex things into simple forms and simple words. And these poor girls, I'm not saying that they were genius, they're not Emily Dickinson, but they weren't afraid to use simple language and express a simple truth.
Yeah.
Which many artists would think, well, you know, I'd look naive, I'd look foolish if I spoke that plainly. They didn't have that inhibition.
That cliche of the ignorance is bliss.
Mm-hmm.
I think for them, although maybe it wasn't blissful for them, bless them, because just the story about them is another reason to read your book is to read the full story on the Shags, and bless them, you know, they were sort of forced into it. But there is a purity, you know, as you say, that sort of ignorance helped them. Wow. Anyway, before we let you go, we'd love to bring it just back to live gigs and just finish with a few questions. The amazing experiences that you've had, and we like these daft questions. We call them sort of our pub questions. We just sat having a drink, and it's your favorite, your worst, you know, the loudest, the smallest, the sweatiest, that kind of thing that Chris and I could just talk about for hours. And we still do, even though we've already spoken to each other for hours and hours about it on the podcast. There's still others. Oh, there was that one, Chris. Or, oh, I forgot about that one.
So a quick fire round.
You carry on, Chris.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I was just going to say, so... what was your favorite gig? So the part of the book, I love reading about, I'd love to find out what your favorite gig for your head is and the favorite gig for your neck down. You talk about this in the book, and the fact that the Stones, it feeds the neck down for you, and the Beatles is more, but your head. And it's really odd because at the moment I'm reading a book with my son. He's 12, and he's reading this book called Risk, The Science and Politics of Fear, by a writer called Dan Gardner, and he talks about decision making and this kind of fight or flight thing, and it's either the decision is based on your head or your gut. Mm-hmm. And it was odd that I was reading your book at the same time as this, because it felt like exactly the same thing, because one is about instinct and the other one is about knowledge. So I just wanted to say it just kind of resonated at the same time. It was really a really odd bit of synchronicity. So yeah, so favorite gig for your head, favorite gig for your gut.
I think the one that kind of blew me away with technical brilliance, but it also really appealed to my heart, but I gotta share this one. Etta James at the
Heart
Cafe in West Hollywood. This was back in the days in the 90s when she was still really heavy, and she was sitting, she was really heavy, so she's sitting on a bar stool at the front of the stage. Now, two of her sons were in the band. I think one was the drummer, and the other, I think he might have been on bass. But so Etta has the mic in her hand, and she's facing the crowd, and with her right hand, she's signaling to her music director. Her music director is her guitar player. So this was a large band, drums and percussion, a lot of players. But you could see the music director, the guitar player, was over on Etta's right. And he's, in the words of T-Bone Burnett, following her like a leopard. He's never taking his eyes off of her, and he's watching her hand signals. The rest of the band is watching him. And I'd never seen anyone form that kind of feedback loop to that degree as Etta did. So Etta was reading the audience and signaling to her band director when to bring it up, when to bring it down, when to go around again, when to cut it short. She's playing to the audience by using a hand signal, and her band director would read her hand signal and look at the band and then signal the rest of the band. That knocked me out. I've been privileged to see great artists who know how to connect with an audience, but I've never seen it done like that before. Her ability to read that audience. She had that audience in a frenzy. She had that audience. I mean, we were sweating and there were, I'm not exaggerating, there were women throwing underwear at her. She was just like, oh, please. I mean, she had the audience in ecstasy. Gosh, that was a great show.
Wow. That is fascinating, because that sort of, she was breaking a boundary there, because that's, as you describe that, I'm just seeing a conductor in front of an orchestra.
Yeah.
And what she's done is sort of bridge that to a modern, you know, slightly more modern. That's amazing.
It was really brilliant. I like to stand, because I've been a record producer, during shows when I can, I like to stand near the stage because I like to watch how the audience responds to certain musical gestures. Mm. That informs you if you're going to make records. What is the audience like? When do they drift back? What brings the girls to the front of the stage? What brings the boys to the front of the stage? You're trying to make that connection. And so I was standing very close to the stage and could watch her and the music director and the audience as well, and see the reactions that she was playing. Damn, that was a great show.
That's amazing. I suppose, I wonder if, and I only saw him once, but James Brown would do a similar thing, but in a very more obvious theatrical way.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and Prince learned that technique as well from James Brown, where he'd just shout out to his band, "Hit me," and it meant a horn stab, hit me two times or hit me five times or just whatever. Yeah, very much a conductor and band leader, which you have to be if you're the lead singer of the band. You have to be a band leader.
Mm. Amazing. So what about your other answer then? What about, you know, the neck down? The heart.
This was a fairly recent concert, 2019. And it was Bob Dylan. It was Bob Dylan.
Yes!
At the Aganis Arena in Boston. And I just so happened to have gotten him where he was great. So here's what we have here. This is a man who is, 3 years ago, how old was he? 80, 79 or whatever?
Yeah. And
He's the records he's been putting out lately, which I love, are the ones where he's uncovering songs. He's doing cover versions or of like the Great American Songbook, all these standards. So he's on stage. This is an old man. He's wearing a white tuxedo jacket. And he's not playing guitar, he's on piano. But sometimes he'd get off that piano and he'd come downstage. It was the cutest thing I ever saw in my life. It's an old man that would stand there and he'd grip the microphone stand with one hand. And it's like he didn't know what to do with his other hand. So he would just take his hand and put his hand on his hip. Like an old man is going to tell you something. And holding us in thrall with that voice. You're hearing an expert, virtuoso musician whose voice is weak and frail. So was Johnny Cash's at the end of his life. So were a lot of people's.
Yeah, exactly.
He knows how to use that instrument. On top of that, his band was led by the great Charlie Sexton. And they were
good. Wow.
Yep. At one point I was sitting there and I'm thinking, I don't think it's humanly possible to play better than this band is playing. Later I read that Bob Dylan said this was the best band he's ever worked with. Stupid good. And how an 80-year-old man can make a woman like, swoon? What do you have to do? It was so good. Then later I found out that a couple of my students were actually in the audience, and one of my favorite students, a young man named Jeremy, said he was at that show, and he said, wasn't that just about the greatest show you ever saw in your life? So it wasn't just me. It wasn't just
Oh, I love that.
You got good Dylan. You got good
you
Dylan.
You got good Dylan.
I've only had bad Dylan. I think a friend of the podcast, Guy, went to see Dylan a few weeks ago.
Yeah, here in Manchester.
And said he got good Dylan as well. So he's still on it. He's still on
it. In fact, this tour, because he's been touring the world, hasn't he, with it? This tour has had rave reviews, actually.
Amazing.
Rave reviews. Or because it has become a joke on this podcast, because so often people, when we've asked the question, worst gig you've ever seen, it would be Dylan. And then, best gig you've ever seen, Dylan. And we're like, it's so funny that so commonly people are going, see, really bad. And really good Dylan. Because often you just see an artist and they're just good, aren't they? They're just consistently good.
I wonder what's up with that. I had the great privilege, and I worked with him as well, to see great John Lydon, Public Image Limited. Great.
Right. Yes.
Yep.
In Hollywood years and years ago when they first came out touring that first album. And then I saw in Minneapolis, I saw bad John Lydon, where he really didn't like the crowd at First Avenue and he just turned his back on the audience. But I worked with him for a week out in LA in the 90s and spent a little time with him. He's a great guy.
Well, of course, Miles could be the same as well. I made a choice back in 1990, and it was the Glasgow Jazz Festival, and I'm a sax player, and I love jazz, but I had a choice. I could either see Miles Davis or Dizzy Gillespie, and I chose Dizzy, and
that, isn't it? That's a horrible choice.
Yeah, but I did make the right. He was with the United Nations Orchestra, which was just the most incredible collection of Cuban musicians, South American musicians, just incredible. And I read reviews of Miles at the same festival, and I think I made the right decision. But he could be good, he could be outstanding, but also could really alienate, I think, in the same way as Lydon or,
Do
you know, people have called me an idiot, but just hearing stuff like that gives me anxiety. The thought of having to make a choice between seeing Miles Davis or Dizzy Gillespie genuinely gives me anxiety. I'm like, oh, you are kidding me.
I had £20.
This is horrific. It's like, you know, I'm very lucky. I go to a lot of festivals and I'm at Glastonbury, you know, every year. And it's that I have to stop now looking at the timetable. Because there's now 90 stages at Glastonbury.
Oh,
and so I have to just stop looking because the anxiety of thinking, what? I have to choose between Paul McCartney and who? No, I can't do this. This is a mess.
Yeah. Paul McCartney, by the way, what a brilliant, brilliant songwriter. My appreciation for him, I wasn't a Beatles fan when I was a kid, but man, my appreciation for him over the years, how that's grown, how brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, did the highlight? I think the highlight of the year for me was watching him headline Glastonbury, and it was also very personal because at my dad's funeral, we carried my dad out to Let It Be, and so he's always been the Beatles and McCartney's always been in my life, and it was lovely to have my daughter with all my family, but my daughter with me watching McCartney, And that was lovely. So when he played Let It Be, of course, obviously there's that emotional attachment and, you know, I just sobbed my heart out. But also and I thought of it as you were speaking about Dylan. Age is a funny thing, isn't it? Because I'm, you know, nearly 46, but in my head, I keep thinking I'm 20s maybe. And so you're sort of surprised when you're like, oh, I'm not. And so therefore people I've grown up with are also getting older. And what was totally, totally wonderful was watching McCartney share anecdotes with us that I'm not sure that I've even heard before. So that was just wonderful. But he was, like you said about Dylan, he's what's McCartney's my mum's age, I think, 78, 79?
Right around that same, yeah.
And it was like, he was like a granddad, but there was a moment where he told us that Peter Jackson, who did the Get Back documentary, I don't know if you've been able to watch that yet.
Haven't yet, no.
Oh, have you not?
That's great.
Yeah, well, you're in for some hours and hours of just I mean, I will be really interested. I'm going to email you when you have watched Get Back, because the footage there is just astonishing. And they recovered the full footage of the full concert on the roof, the now infamous concert on the roof. And Peter Jackson, when he found out that McCartney was going to go on tour, which was in the past year, contacted him and said, "Do you know what we're able to do? You can duet with John Lennon." And so there's this moment at Glastonbury where McCartney is talking about one of his very best friends in all the world. And it didn't matter about music and the Beatles. He was talking about one of his very best friends in the whole world who, you know, hadn't died of old age, was tragically taken from a shot, you know. And he turns around, and I've got this wonderful picture, and there's this, you know, the TV camera saw it. And John is on the back. And what they did is they duetted by playing John's version of the song from the rooftop. And then they were able to clean up the sound so that we, as we were there in the crowd, we couldn't hear a change in sort of quality. And watching Paul duet with John Lennon, may have been one of the greatest experiences of my life, you know. And it was just... because there was so much more in there because of the history and because he's older and because it was incredible. And so maybe that's what artists do, you know, like Dylan, that they have that ability now because they're age, just to, you know, keep us in. Anyway.
I wanted to share one little moment with you because we were talking earlier about that connection with the audience.
Yes, yes.
And whether the performer's connecting or not. I remembered this just now and it was interesting. So this would have been about 20 years ago. I was an undergraduate in college, and Brian Wilson came through my University of Minnesota, playing Pet Sounds.
Right, yes.
They're going to do Pet Sounds and some other songs too. But during the set, they're going to do the whole album Pet Sounds from top to bottom.
Yeah.
So he played some songs, and then Brian is up there with his bass. He's getting ready to do Pet Sounds. He's tuning his bass. And then, you know, you tune your bass and you play, just play a few notes. You play just a little melodic sequence, make sure it's in tune. And I was sitting fairly close and I got the sense of, he's not tuning anymore, is he? So he played this little riff. He did a variation on it. And I could feel him and see him go into his own head. And he played another variation on it. And he raised his head up and he looked and he said, "Did I just do that out loud?"
What?
Yes, it was witnessing the moment of creation for one of our great living musical minds. And I thought of Brian because he's in that same age group as Paul McCartney and others. And I also thought of him because he's a great example of a bass player who writes, like Sting and Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
Brian, bass players write. Ooh la la. That seeing that on stage and to have him, he's as candid as a child, to have him look at the audience and say, "Did I just do that out loud?" That was a beautiful moment.
That's amazing.
Well, this is another reason why you need to watch Get Back, because there's a scene in Get Back where he forces the song Get Back. They're up against it. They need to write. And you just see him write it in the space of minutes. Oh. And it's like he bullies the guitar and gets frustrated. And by sheer force of will, he creates this tune.
It's phenomenal.
Boggling.
It's phenomenal.
We're going to have to wind it up very shortly.
We need to bring this to an end. And do you know what? I think we should just have one final question.
Because
that was such a nice... I'm almost tempted just to bring the podcast to an end there, because what a lovely... But we always ask all our guests for one recommendation. And it's funny how the recommendation has changed, because when we first started the podcast, it was just a live album. And I can't even remember what your first one was, Chris. I think mine was Under a Blood Red Sky. I used to play that over and over, U2's. But it's now become just a live musical moment. So it could be a live album. It could be a video. And actually, one that is chosen by a few of our guests happens to be Prince. When he has that now infamous guitar solo, where he walks on stage. Who was actually being inducted? I can't remember.
I can't remember, but it's the one with Tom Petty and Jeff Lynne, and it is While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And at the end of the solo, he throws his guitar in the air and it seems to disappear. No, but that's the example that we give as an example of a performance on YouTube, a live performance.
It is, let's be honest, that particular moment is one of the greatest things ever caught on camera. It's just brilliant because Prince just walks on and does what with the guitar now? You've just what in front of all those people?
Yeah,
the guy was more than a genius.
There is that anecdote of somebody asking Eric Clapton, "What does it feel like to be the world's greatest guitar player?" And he said, "I don't know. Ask Prince."
Yeah,
I don't know if that's apocryphal or not, but Prince was great. That was a great moment. I can't think of a great live moment captured on camera. I don't tend to watch a lot of music. Enjoy it as much captured on camera. I love live concerts, but a live album that I'm going to sound like a snob now, but I really love Jazz at Massey Hall. Because five of the greatest musical minds in modern music that ever existed got together for one night only. And that was my favorite musician in the whole world, Bud Powell on piano, Charles Mingus on bass, Max Roach on drums, and then Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie live at Massey Hall. When you play the parlor game of fantasy, if you could go and be present at any event in history, what would you like to have been present for? That's one that springs right to mind.
Imagine
being in that audience and seeing seeing Jimi Hendrix live. I mean, there's just so many, but boy, that always comes to mind.
Oh,
that
absolutely.
We'll have to look. Do you know what year that was?
1953.
53? Was it that?
Yeah, Jazz at Massey Hall.
That early?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of my favorite live experiences was seeing the Charlie Mingus Big Band in New York at Fez. And I don't know if I've talked about this in the pod before, but we paid for the first session. And then our minds were blown so much that we paid and just stayed in the same booth for the second session. Just the way he gives musicians freedom to express themselves is quite something.
Can you imagine seeing Frank Sinatra in his prime? Can you imagine? I wrote about it in the book. Frank Sinatra with the Count Basie Orchestra led by 25-year-old Quincy Jones.
Yes. Yes.
That's a live album. Sinatra at the Sands. You're hearing a maestro, a vocal maestro at his peak. And pay close attention to his phrasing. He was a virtuoso. Elvis Presley was a maestro before he got into the army, but Elvis Presley on guitar, how he leads the band with guitar, and how Scotty Moore and Bill, they just follow him. His bass and drums follow him because Elvis was on fire early in his career.
Mm.
A lot of great stuff.
Oh man, Susan, we could literally chat to you all day. You are I'm just and I mean this, you are an incredible woman. Especially when you talk about you know, the generation you were brought up in and your personal circumstances. I am so pleased that you broke free, that all those cliches, you know, I am telling my daughters about you. And we haven't even mentioned that you were literally one of a few doing your job through the 80s, 90s. And you know, it's just incredible. You're incredible. The book is fantastic. And
I need to thank my wife, because she was listening to you being interviewed on Radio 4 a few weeks ago. And she said, "Chris, you need to get this book because it's absolute." And she's a voice coach. She works with actors with their voices, and so the idea of examining sound and the reasons behind your decisions, whether it's conscious or subconscious. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Colette for saying you need to do this, because I did. I really did. And you do too, listener. You need to get this book.
You need to. Honestly, it is just wonderful. So, Susan, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
I think the three of us are clearly cut from the same cloth, and it's been so much fun talking with you. And I agree, we could talk for hours, because this is just a delightful topic.
Told you it was good. Told you it was good.
Can you imagine a time in your life where you've... Oh, hang on, phone's going. Sorry, Chris, it's Prince. Hi, Prince. Oh, you want me to pop over your house? Yeah. Why? Oh, you're having dinner with your dad and Miles Davis, and you want me to bring four tracks? Yeah, no problem. Yeah, I can do that. First of all, let's not just go about anecdotes. A genuinely amazing brain. I love how she thinks about music, and I love that she is one of the greatest musicians and is not a musician as well. Nice one, Miles Davis. I love how she thinks about music and how she's written that book. But also, it was also nice to hear some of her anecdotes, and literally just some of them. That there are more in her book, and we really should have her on again. It was a fascinating woman, eh?
Totally. Go and get her book, or get the book on audiobook. That's what I've got both. I've been reading it, but I've also been listening to it. And she narrates the book on Audible, and it's great. She's just very easy to listen to and very funny. She's really funny. Got great delivery.
Dr. Susan, thank you. We bloody love you.
Before we clock off for Christmas, just wanted to ask about. There's my dog.
Hello.
Hiya. Music tunes. What's your favorite Christmas music?
Oh God! I tell you what, that it causes some chats, doesn't it, on social media? All Christmas music, and the thing is, obviously, we all know how much I love music, but Christmas, I'm one of those really silly people. I have a massive obsession for Christmas and nostalgia and memories. And, you know, as has been plainly obvious on this podcast, I react very emotionally to songs, and specifically Christmas songs. So I do find it difficult if we're going to have proper musical chat, because I realize that I have varying opinions on Christmas music, and there's very few that I think are shite. I love a lot of Christmas music. I will put those Christmas albums on and playlists on and just let them play through. And there's very few that I will skip.
Well, oddly, one of the ones which I would never put on a playlist, and we mentioned him in this episode.
I know what you're going to say, and I am absolutely going to disagree with you. Can I just see if I can guess? Are you going to say Sir Paul McCartney?
Yes.
Ah, you're wrong. You're wrong. You're trying to spoil Christmas for everyone.
Simply having a wonderful Christmas time.
Yes. Yes.
I'm not when I'm listening to that music. Oh my God. It's like an assault.
It's brilliant.
It's like he's the hostage taker, and you're the hostage, and you say, yes, we are having a wonderful Christmas time. We're simply having a wonderful Christmas. That's all we're doing here. There's no hostaging going on.
Bar humbug. Bar humbug, Scrooge. Ebenezer
so,
Payne.
I would say they're my go-tos, the 90s trilogy.
Oh, what are you calling the 90s trilogy?
Well, Stay Another Day, obviously. He's 17.
Ugh, God. Like seriously? So you just ripped into Paul McCartney, but you're absolutely going to big up E 17 Stay Another Day?
Yes, I am.
Absolute tripe.
I was born on Christmas Day, obviously.
Right, what about your next song? Hey!
Hey.
Oh, I do love that.
Tim Burgess. Because it's 90s, Don't Let the Bells End.
By?
The Darkness.
The Darkness. I could not think of them. All I could think of was Lycra. I'll be honest. That's the first word I was like, Lycra. But they also had Christmas Time.
Don't Let the Bells End.
Oh, is that what it is?
That's what it is.
I thought they had two Christmas ones, and I thought you'd named the one. Oh,
that was
yeah,
it.
No, that is a good one.
Yeah.
I did that air guitar at a Christmas light switch on with kids in Durham, and they flipping loved it.
Yeah.
It is a banger. It's a banger, that
it's
one.
Absolutely.
That's not the 90s, though. It's The Darkness. Yeah. Was that 90s?
Yeah, it's about 98.
No. 99. No.
Is it not about 99?
I'm going to have to check on that. Yeah. Because that just makes me feel so old.
Mm.
I love The Snowman. So Walking in the Air, right?
Mm.
Because what comes with that is I think The Snowman, so this splits into music and films. When people ask me for my top films, The Snowman is in my top five. I think it's a perfect film.
Mm.
It is one of the greatest films ever made. And the soundtrack from start to finish is breathtaking. It's so, so beautiful. And so even that song, and I'm sure, you know, people listening to either the film version or the Ali Jones version, I prefer the film version. And I always watch the David Bowie one, of course, as well. And we actually watch it every Christmas Eve as a family. And then we watch The Snowman and Snow Dog afterwards.
Which has got great music as well.
And I love the albums that Andy Burrows does with, you know, Smith and Burrows. That is great Christmas music.
Yeah.
But I do love Mariah Carey has just nailed, not just Christmas song, but just a song. It's one of the best pop songs. Yeah. And you're going to disagree with that? Okay. So you're willing, in front of all three of our listeners, to say you actively listen to E17 Stay Another Day, but Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas.
Yeah, all day long.
Listeners, we hope you've enjoyed the Gig Stories podcast.
Can I just suggest
everything
one
has
other
to come to an end? No, because that is a massive bombshell.
You need to expand
on why Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas is You. It is not up your alley.
It just rubs me up the wrong way. That's all. I don't know why. It just rubs me. I'd rather listen to Do They Know It's Christmas?
Yeah, that's great as well.
Yeah.
Well, tonight, thank God it's them instead of you. God. Come on. I think you find The Darkness Christmas Time is 2004. So
2004?
You and your 90s threesome. You forget you're 65 years old now, mate.
I am. Can I just suggest one more, which is Another Lonely Christmas, right? So 1984 on the B-side of I Would Die For You, Prince had Another Lonely Christmas, and it is one of the best, if not the best, Christmas tunes ever. And it was produced, sound engineered by Dr. Susan.
Yay! Robinson.
That's going to go on the accompanying Spotify playlist for this episode, as well as some of the other tunes that Susan touched on, some of the bands that she mentioned. I'm going to try and find some, or at least one tune, in inverted commas, by The Shags. So we'll see how that goes.
It's incredible.
I've
genuinely listened to that album. I was in the car and I thought, I am going to get through this album. you have to listen to it. If you're a fan of music, you have to listen to it. Because it's just, what an experience. What an experience. It's going to sound very similar to the band that Chris and I eventually start.
Yeah, but without the
Because talent. Chris will be keeping time, and then there'll be me just doing some stuff. You are going to love it. So have a wonderful Christmas from me and from Scrooge over there.
Merry Christmas!